Hello, and welcome to Blood, Sweat, and Smears, a podcast produced by Machion Diagnostics. In this podcast series, we will be discussing thrombosis and hemostasis from the perspective of our host, benign hematologist, and medical director of Machion Diagnostics, Dr. Brad Lewis. Please remember to subscribe and leave a review. With that, I'll turn it over to Dr. Lewis. Brad, take it away.
Everyone, welcome back to another podcast in the Blood, Sweat, and Smears series. So today we're going to talk about TMAs. We're going to talk about thrombotic microangiopathy in pregnancy. This is a fairly large and possibly growing area. I think a lot of times we've thought about the TMAs in the past as a non-obstetrician. I thought about it as something that was really just the TTP and maybe some AHUS stuff, and everything else was different. I think more and more we're beginning to see TMAs, at least from my side, as being a much broader sort of an issue encompassing preeclampsia and HELLP syndrome and some other things you're going to hear about shortly. I think the big issues I wanted to make sure we talked about today was, when are you going to want to suspect this disease? The sensitivity of not looking for TMAs in pregnancy is very, very small. It's something you're really going to want to think about. How can you go about thinking about it? How do you go about diagnosing it? And really, the elephant in the room, and we will talk about it here, is what about therapeutic differences? Does it make a difference to make this diagnosis? And the point is, it did 10 years ago. Make the diagnosis, don't make the diagnosis, it didn't matter. It was like collecting rare stamps. It just didn't matter. Today, with therapies that are extremely effective, if you can make the right diagnosis, and not so much if you don't make the right diagnosis, I think it makes a difference. So to actually talk about in some seriousness what we're going to be dealing with today, I brought Dr. Richard Berwick from Cedars-Sinai. So Dr. Berwick is a high-risk obstetrician, primarily a clinician, he would always say, but he has a big research interest, particularly in complement-mediated diseases of pregnancy and in eclampsia and HELLP syndrome, which, as I said, I think of as being complement-mediated diseases. He got his training at Johns Hopkins and then UC San Francisco and then UC Los Angeles and then went to Harvard Women's Hospital. He's kind of been around, but he settled back into UCLA and Cedars-Sinai. Got about 45 articles, has a recent one coming out, if some of you want to look for it, looking at the role of complement in pregnancy. And he has a couple of trials going on in COVID and preeclampsia with complement blockading drugs. And also he's part of a very large multi-center study that looks at biomarkers in pregnancy, particularly complement disease-related biomarkers in pregnancy. So clearly the right person to be talking about this stuff. So with that, let me kind of hand this over to some extent to Dr. Berwick, but maybe you can start and just tell us, why are we having this conversation? Who cares about TMAs in pregnancy?
Thank you. Thank you, Dr. Lewis, for having me and for that introduction and sharing with your listeners on this important topic. Yeah, two areas that are really growing is complement and complement-mediated disorders in pregnancy, and then TMA, the thrombotic microangiopathy disorders in pregnancy, and a lot of, obviously, overlap between the two. I got into this area actually as a fellow. When I was a fellow at Harvard, as you mentioned, I got into the world of complement and its role in preeclampsia and HELLP syndrome. And then I started to learn more about atypical HUS as a complement-mediated disorder, particularly, as mentioned, that we have therapeutics, the growing amount of therapeutics that target the complement pathway. And obviously, atypical HUS having an FDA-approved treatment through complement blockade, that really piqued my interest. And I started seeing particularly pregnant women and postpartum women with renal failure, unexplained renal failure. And it was often attributed to other conditions, preeclampsia, HELLP, postpartum hemorrhage, or other pregnancy complications. But the renal failure would persist and it wouldn't get better after delivery. And I was like, these are young, healthy women. They entered the pregnancy with healthy kidneys. They should leave the pregnancy with healthy kidneys. And I truly believed that. And when I researched it, I found there weren't many things that could cause a woman who was previously healthy to have chronic kidney disease or progressive end-stage renal disease, really other than atypical HUS. And so that got me into being an advocate for identifying this disease and treating it appropriately, and also ruling out other conditions. You alluded to maybe TTP or maybe other mimickers of different TMA disorders. And really help and educate providers of how to recognize when they have a case that might really warrant treatment.
Super. So one of the things I hear sometimes from people is that these diseases are so rare that who cares, really? And obviously part of the answer is the person who cares is the patient. So even though it's a rare disease, it still matters. The incidence of this disease, do you have any good sense? People sometimes talk about 1 in 25,000 pregnancies. I suspect that's low, but any thoughts about incidence?
Yeah, you know, that incidence of 1 in 25,000, I do agree. I think it's higher than that. That study actually was combining TTP and atypical HUS because, as you know, in the past, TTP-HUS was one diagnosis because it has a similar phenotype, and it didn't matter. Like you said, for treatment, it didn't really make a difference. But now, because TTP is treated with plasma exchange and atypical HUS with complement blockade, it's really important to know the difference between the two. And we don't actually have good incidence data, but I can tell you, for example, at Cedars-Sinai, we have about 6,000 to 6,500 deliveries per year. And I see about, I mean, at least 2 to 3 cases per year in pregnancy associated. So, you know, that's 2 to 3 per 6,000 there. You could kind of do the math. That's higher than 1 in 25,000. And you're exactly right that these cases are the sickest patients. And we say we're very passionate about maternal morbidity and mortality. Of course, everybody is, but particularly recently, there's been a lot of interest in why is there maternal mortality. One of the leading causes of maternal mortality is thrombotic microangiopathy. TTP and atypical HUS are two things that really can be life-threatening if they're not treated appropriately. And the women that we've diagnosed and treated, they get better. I mean, if you make the right diagnosis and you provide the right treatment, they actually recover quickly versus in the literature, when you see it's not treated, women can progress to end-stage renal disease, dialysis, and renal transplant, which is, you know, unfortunate. But luckily, in this day and age, we have options to treat them.
So you mentioned the maternal complications. How about fetal impacts? Is there much of an impact on the fetus?
You know, the main fetal risk is going to be related to the delivery timing. Most of when we think of neonatal complications is preterm birth and prematurity. But many women are delivered for presumed other conditions, preeclampsia, HELP. And actually, if the diagnosis was atypical HUS, perhaps they could have avoided preterm birth if they had been treated appropriately. So one is just if you have the right diagnosis and the right treatment, you may actually prevent a preterm birth, which would have dramatic implications. The other, of course, is atypical HUS is a genetic disorder. 50 to 60% or more have identifiable genetic mutations, and the fetus is going to have a 50% chance of inheriting that from mom. And so that's going to be important to know from a pediatric standpoint, because we know there's also pediatric cases. But fortunately, if mom does well and mom is in good, the baby's health is going to be tied to mom. So if mom is doing well and we could keep mom pregnant, then the baby outcome will be much better.
So when do you think about pregnancy? When do you think about TMAs in pregnancy? You have a woman who comes in, she's having a pregnancy, it's maybe complicated a little bit by whatever. When do you jack it up and you stop thinking about, well, this is just blank, I need to start getting more serious, I need a call for help? When do you begin to think this might be a TMA of pregnancy? And then further, when do you think about HUS?
Right. It's a great question. And I always remind people that it starts off as a clinical diagnosis the vast majority of the time. So you have to have the clinical suspicion. That's usually going to present with the classic features of hemolysis, thrombocytopenia, renal failure. Now, I always say that there's not many things that cause those three things in combination. You can argue maybe HELLP syndrome, but usually even with HELLP syndrome, there's not often a significant amount of renal failure to the degree that you see in the atypical HUS. Because it can be similar to HELLP syndrome, the time periods where you're most suspicious for TMA is a period of time where you don't usually have HELLP syndrome, like under 20 weeks of pregnancy. So the first 20 weeks of pregnancy, we say you can't have preeclampsia or HELLP syndrome in the first half of pregnancy. So in a sense, those are easier ones to diagnose. If someone presents with hemolysis and renal failure in the first half of pregnancy, again, now we've ruled out preeclampsia HELLP. So I immediately am thinking that I want to work up for TMA. Then likewise, postpartum, because HELLP syndrome is treated with delivery. So if someone is now 2 to 3 days out from delivery, and again, they have hemolysis and renal failure, you can no longer blame the preeclampsia and HELLP syndrome because they've been delivered. You've given it a couple days. A couple days should be enough time you should see some improvement. But with atypical HUS, especially pregnancy associated, it tends to worsen postpartum. It often presents postpartum and it worsens. That's not true for preeclampsia and HELLP. Preeclampsia and HELLP get better postpartum. So I always say, if something is not getting better, And in fact, it's getting worse, and particularly the renal failure, because we know with atypical HUS, really the dominance of the renal failure, and then that points you in that direction.
So my experience has been that a lot of obstetricians call me and they have somebody during the pregnancy and they're thinking about TMAs and they just can't move forward. I don't know if you have thoughts or things you want to pass on to the obstetrician who probably has never seen a case of AHUS ever in many of their careers, at least not that they've recognized. How do you get off that pot? You know, how do you decide, look, it's a TMA, it's not anything else. Where do I go from here? You've alluded to the renal failure. Any other thoughts?
Yeah, it's a common problem. Actually, most of the lectures I give a lot of talks around the country, it's usually to nephrologists and hematologists because OBGYNs say exactly that. I don't know anything about atypical HUS. Why do I even need to know about atypical HUS? But I try to phrase it more as understanding of TMA disorders because then that's a more broad umbrella. And then I remind obstetricians that they see more TMA than anybody in the world because HELLP syndrome is defined by macroangiopathic hemolytic anemia. It was defined by schistocytes on the peripheral smear, thrombocytopenia. And you could argue that HELLP syndrome is TMA disorder. The difference with HELLP is the renal failure is not as prominent. So, you know, that's always the point of emphasis. And I hone in on that. One reason they don't think of TMA is because the other thing is that from nephrologist's point of view and even hematologist, they often want to see schistocytes. And the truth is we don't often see the schistocytes. And I've always said, where have the schistocytes gone? Now, if you have schistocytes, people are a little bit more attentive to it. But one, people aren't ordering peripheral smears. OBs are not ordering peripheral smears. They don't really work up hemolysis. Even in patients with HELLP syndrome, right now the American College of OBGYN doesn't recommend routine screening for hemolysis in patients with preeclampsia. So many providers don't. They might start with an LDH. It's elevated, they just stop there. They don't check haptoglobin, retic count, peripheral smear. So there has to be education that we need to look for hemolysis or we're never going to find it. So one is we're not looking for it. And traditionally, OBGYNs have said, well, I don't need to test for hemolysis because I'm going to look at the platelets. I'm going to look at the liver enzymes. And I'll just assume that the hemolysis is there because surely if there's low platelets, there must be hemolysis. And I always make the argument, that's not true. That is not true. Sometimes there's hemolysis and the platelets are normal. Sometimes there's low platelets, but there's no hemolysis. You don't know unless you look. So that's educational on that part. Two is that you can have TMA without peripheral schistocytes. And that's, I've learned that from nephrologists and hematologists, and I've seen it firsthand, that the schistocytes, especially in the acute setting, can be removed from circulation by the reticular endothelial system, or they're all in the kidney. So then the only way you know is with a renal biopsy. Many OBGYNs and nephrologists are not excited to do a renal biopsy on a postpartum patient or definitely a pregnant patient. You know, part of it is, yeah, the OBGYNs recognizing that they could start looking for TMA because OBGYNs are not familiar with the term TMA. That's why I first try to tell them you are because you treat HELLP syndrome and this is a common disorder. So one, I say, okay, understand that. Two is understanding the differential diagnosis and how you might search for signs of a microangiopathic process because many OBGYNs are familiar with testing LDH. They know that LDH is a marker for hemolysis, but they don't know how to follow that up. You know, how do you find out what's causing the LDH elevation? So the haptoglobin tells you, okay, this is red cell hemolysis. The Coombs test is going to tell you, right, is it an autoimmune hemolysis? There's schistocytes or spherocytes. These are things that OBs can, I think, learn. Many times, you're right, they do rely on their hematology colleagues or in some cases nephrology, but sometimes that means they wait until the patient's more sick and then you're behind and you need to catch up. So if the OBGYNs can start the workup, that's critical because that way when the consultant comes in, they already have the information and they can move forward more quickly.
Yeah, just a second, a bit of what you said. I think everyone tends to depend on the lab to tell us, to look at the smears and tell us if people have schistocytes. My experience has been that the lab routinely misses schistocytes on the smears. And like you said, maybe a quarter of people with TTP or AHUS will present without schistocytes initially. Most of them will get the schistocytes down the road, but they may not be there even when I'm looking with my with all my senses primed to look for every possible schistocyte. You still don't see them sometimes. You mentioned the differential. We've kind of come back to this a couple of times. Somebody comes in, they've got a bit of hypertension, I assume. They've got maybe a little bit of renal failure, some proteinuria. Platelets are a little bit low. They look, the LDH is up a little bit. Hemoglobin is maybe down a little bit. The ticks are up a little bit. What do you think about? What are the things you have to think about?
Yeah, that's a great question. So I think the main, obviously in pregnancy, yes, we are thinking about preeclampsia health syndrome, but I look for signs that maybe something's not quite right, something's a little bit off. If we have a chance to do a workup and not immediately deliver the patient, the things that I really want to look for are things that obviously we can target treatment. So TTP, and TTP is with an ADAM TS13 level. We could start that workup, and then we have a reflex to determine if there's autoantibodies to ADAM TS13. Now, TTP would obviously, I'd be thinking someone where the platelets are very low, but there's not as much renal failure. You're right, they may have a lot of hemolysis, they may have schistocytes, they may have low platelets, but maybe the kidney function is not impaired as dramatically. Then I'm thinking of TTP as well, and then I want to send the ADAM TS13. Now, as an OBGYN, I do push my residents and fellows to send it. You know, many OBGYNs have never sent an ADAM TS13, but we're often the first ones to, like you said, see a patient with thrombocytopenia. So for me, when I see a patient, pregnant patient with platelets under 70,000, I send ADAM TS13. And I do that because I'd rather start the process of having that test sent out, because it's not always immediately available, and I want to send it as soon as possible. Two, I'm thinking of atypical HUS. There's not specific tests other than the LDH, platelets, creatinine, but we can do some things like the C3, C4. If those are low, then I'm thinking, yes, there is some complement involvement. The typical pattern might be a low C3 with a normal C4, whereas with, like, say, a lupus-mediated process, we may see more C4 low, because then it's more immune complex mediated. It gets into CH50, the hemolytic CH50, because that will be elevated, but there can be some turnaround time with that. A urine sediment, I think the sediment is also helpful if you're not ready for, you know, say a renal biopsy yet. The other thing I've seen is a pseudo-TMA. We had a case of B12 deficiency. So if I see hemolysis, thrombocytopenia, again, and I don't see a lot of renal failure, and I see anemia, I also think of B12, and we did have a case of pernicious anemia that looked a lot like HELLP syndrome. And so B12 deficiency is also easily treatable. And then the last one is Chiga toxin. You would tend to think of GI symptoms, maybe diarrhea, especially bloody stools, and then you can send Chiga toxin. But I send Chiga toxin regardless, even if there's no GI symptoms, partly because it's actually required. If you get into the point of complement blockade, most insurers are going to require that you have an ADAM TS13 on the books and you have a Chiga toxin on the books to prove that you rule those out.
Yeah, so I think in terms of this getting off the pot notion, the differential seems to be fairly small. You have HELLP syndrome, you have preeclampsia early on, and once they start getting renal failure, it's really TTP or HUS. And actually, if there's a lot of renal failure, it makes you, as you say, it makes you think an awful lot about HUS. Just to toot our own horn, one of the things that comes up often when this discussion happens is people say, yeah, but I can't get an ADAM TS13. I actually just heard this today from a professor at a major university who said it takes him up to a week to get an ADAM TS13. So he makes the decision without it. One of the things Macheon Labs offers is a 24-hour turnaround on an ADAM TS13. And we do it in California, but we do it everywhere in the entire United States. We actually do it in 16 other countries around the world. There's no excuse for anyone in the United States, certainly, to not have a 24-hour turnaround. You can always get it to us. And then people say, yeah, but my hospital doesn't send it there. Every hospital can send it to us. You talked about some of the other labs. So CBC, creatinine, looking at a urine sediment, checking for proteinuria, checking an LDH and a retic count, you're getting there. You get that ADAM TS13. And then you mentioned doing complement studies, especially if the ADAM TS13 comes back and it's not unmeasurable, it's not low. You mentioned the other complement studies, C3, C4. Again, you can get those fairly quickly. C3 is sometimes normal, about 80% of the time it's normal in AHUS. And actually more than that, you may know better than I do, but I think even more than that in pregnancy, because it's an acute phase reactant. It tends to go up a bit in pregnancy. One of the things we offer is a soluble C5B9. That's actually the end of that complement cascade. That's the thing that gets made when the complement system gets out of whack. And we can measure that and we can turn that around quickly too. So that too is an option. And for people who forget that when the time comes, call Macheon. And we're actually very happy to walk you through what the options are and how best to approach this kind of thing. We talked about when you think about PMAs, and especially when you think about AHUS, what about family history, personal histories? Is that something that you see much where people come in and say, you know, my previous pregnancy was complicated, or I actually had a kid where, who when they were three had an episode of renal failure and were told they probably had AHUS, and then they came back in at 26 with their next episode and they had AHUS.
Yeah, I think it renews interest in the family history. I compare it a lot to a DVT-PE. It's ingrained in our mind that DVT-PEs, a fraction of those can be genetic, although with atypical HOS, it's a much higher percentage that are genetic, but that renews the importance of the family history, personal and family history. As you mentioned, sometimes it's a personal history from childhood, but it could be a sibling, could be a parent. Obviously, it could come from either parent. And then, you know, the most obvious is, yeah, a family history of unexplained renal failure, or maybe someone got sick and said, oh, yeah, I went in and my kidneys went out. You know, maybe their kidneys are fine, but you're right, they had some episode that sounds like a transient atypical HUS episode. Also, family history of HELLP syndrome, recurrent preeclampsia, recurrent HELLP syndrome. You know, when you start looking at complement-mediated disorders, and that's my bias, my research is proven that I think preeclampsia and HELLP are complement-mediated. I've looked at that marker C5b-9, and it is a good marker in those conditions as well. So I believe that there, you know, you start looking at history of disorders that may be complement-mediated, and that's going to raise your index of suspicion. Likewise with maybe TTP, although less so because we think of TTP as being acquired autoantibodies. But actually, I would point out, you know, your test, and I use Meishan myself for the panels, and there's a lot of benefits, like you said, the rapid turnaround with the test in. Also, for TTP, Meishan test for congenital TTP, Upshaw-Schulman. This was actually very helpful in a case we had where we diagnosed atypical HUS. I wanted to treat with complement blockade, but the others were convinced that the patient had TTP. And I said, well, look at the ADAM TS13 was low normal, but it was normal. There were no autoantibodies. And they said, well, it must be Upshaw-Schulman, congenital TTP. And I said, nope, I already got the Meishan results back. There's no congenital TTP. And they were impressed. They said, you have that back? You did genetic testing for Upshaw-Schulman? I'm like, yeah, it was part of the Meishan genetic panel. Also the B12. So there's also screening for, we did have one patient that had variant that predisposed to B12 deficiency associated disease. And then Meishan test for resistance to eculizumab, complement blockade. So if you are entertaining complement blockade, you also already know if the patient has this variant where they're going to be resistant. So yeah, you get the, you know, I didn't mention the genetic testing earlier, but I usually am getting really to the point of doing that when I'm really considering treatment for atypical HUS, because one, other providers want to see the genetics. Sometimes people are not convinced of the diagnosis and that can help. Two, it guides length of treatment. And for pregnancy, you're right, it has implications for inheritance to the fetus or neonate, and it has implications for future pregnancy. So I'm definitely, you know, a big fan of using Meishan as well.
Yeah, I think in terms of getting off the pot when you're stuck there, sometimes the genetic testing can be incredibly helpful. Just again, to toot the Meishan horn, this can take a week to a month or more when you send this test out. We get it done in about 2 days if you're in a hurry. Let us know if you want it stat, and it's 2 days. Routinely, we get it done in about five working days. So we can really bring it back to you, like you said, real time, while the patient's still there, while you're still trying to make your decision. Just a warning that about 40% of the time, even in people who clearly have AHUS, they're clearly going to get better with eculizumab. The genetic testing can be normal. And this can be a problem for some people who are on the fence trying to make up their mind. They get a negative test and they think they've been told that the patient doesn't have the disease, and that's not necessarily true. You said it at the beginning, I'll just say it again. It's a clinical diagnosis. If you really think somebody has AHUS, they really have it. And you aren't going to dissuade yourself, or you're not going to dissuade me by having normal genetics. Along that same line, what about renal biopsies? Is that something you ever go to during pregnancy?
Yeah, you know, more postpartum. You know, the times where we do them pregnancy is first half of pregnancy. I think, you know, it's interesting in pregnancy because under 20 weeks, providers, OBs, and specialists are willing to do a little bit more of a workup because they recognize that under 20 weeks, you know, one, they're thinking of maybe lupus nephritis in certain cases. Oftentimes they biopsy because they're thinking of lupus. They're often not thinking of a TMA, although I'm always thinking, good, I want to find out if there's a TMA. but sometimes it does turn out to be lupus nephritis, and there can be a lupus-associated TMA, so it gets pretty complex. But first half of pregnancy, I think acute renal failure that's unexplained, I think those are good patients for biopsy because it's going to guide treatment. They have, you know, you can't deliver them yet. You would basically be obviously terminating the pregnancy. So, or maybe you need to guide them to make an appropriate decision for the pregnancy. So first half of pregnancy is a really important time. Postpartum also is a useful time because if someone has delivered and their kidney function is persistent, now you're worried that they're going to morph into chronic kidney disease and you need to know what the diagnosis is. Obviously, if the creatinine gets better quickly after delivery, I'm a little bit, I'm not going to push for renal biopsy, but if the creatinine is remaining elevated, the cutoff varies. For sure, I would say above 2, maybe even 1.5, but for sure, if you're having a persistent creatinine above 2 postpartum, I ask my nephrologist if they'll do a renal biopsy because I say that I can't explain, you know, why this woman has persistent kidney injury. But often, actually, we've had a couple cases postpartum where we make the clinical diagnosis of atypical HUS. You know, maybe you have an normal ADAM TS13, and then we're stuck with that decision of biopsy versus a trial of complement blockade. And then what I do is I have a discussion with the nephrologist, and I say, okay, look, we could do a biopsy to find out if there really is TMA there, or we could just do a trial of complement blockade. And based on the clinical diagnosis, we've already made the clinical diagnosis. And actually, I would say the last 3 to 4 cases, we've just done the trial of complement blockade, and it's worked every time. And the patient's kidneys have recovered every time. And so I've seen that trend, that there is a decrease in renal biopsy. It seems to be a little bit reserved for people with either persistent or more severe disease.
Yeah, I could say exactly the same thing about doing a trial of eculizumab or complement blockade. One of the pushbacks I often get when I say that is, yeah, but this is a drug that costs you $500,000 a year. I'm not spending that much money. And I suspect you get the same pushback. But really, one dose just costs the price of one dose. And that's all it takes so often is a dose or two to get a pretty good sense. I don't know if you have the same pushback.
Yeah, I say one, this is an FDA-approved treatment. Now, there's the inpatient versus outpatient. Hospitals actually have less of a problem with outpatient eculizumab because of the insurance coverage. Inpatient do hesitate a little bit more, but I make the same argument as you. If we treat early, I'm talking one dose, maybe we get the patient out of the hospital after one dose. Sometimes it's true we've needed 2 doses because it's a week apart, but our patients, because they're young, healthy women, prior to this event that happened, their kidneys can recover quite quickly. I find that day 4, day 5 after, say, receiving eculizumab, they have clear signs of improvement. You feel much better getting them out of the hospital. They're not requiring dialysis. So from a hospital level, there's no dialysis. There's less ICU time. There's less hospital time. And then long-term, they're not going to interact with the healthcare system as much because they're going to recover. You know, then you could arrange, you can arrange the outpatient infusions. But you're right, it is the financial aspect comes into play. But I make those points. These women should be able to recover their kidney. The cost of long-term renal failure is expensive, societal standpoint, but also, like you said, to the individual, let's focus on the patient. My job as a doctor is to treat the patient. If I get pushback, my job is just continuous to fight for the patient.
The other thing I sometimes see is the patient's been diagnosed with a TMA, got started on plasma exchange because of the possibility of TTP. Somebody sends off the ADAM TS13, and it comes back and it's low. It's 40 or 50. And just to say it, the ADAM TS13 in TTP is 0. It's unmeasurably low almost always. If somebody wants to get prissy about this, they can call me, because you do occasionally see ADAM TS13s in that 10 to 20% range. That can be tricky. Talk to me. There are often ways around that kind of problem, but it's almost always going to be unmeasurably low. If it's 20 or 30%, that'll come through marked as low, but that is not TTP. But I see people who get those kind of levels, and even when they know it's not TTP, they go on with the plasma exchange. Is that something you run into, having people get off the plasma exchange bandwagon?
Yeah, you know, if I can help it, if it's a postpartum patient, we've had a couple of patients that we just make the clinical diagnosis of atypical HUS. We don't think it's TTP, so we just start treating for atypical HUS. But I've had other patients, especially when they are a little bit sicker, more acute, everybody's nervous. TTP is life-threatening, so there's a push to do plasma exchange, which is, of course, fine, because when a patient presents acutely, they're sick, platelets are low, we don't want anything bad to happen. But you're right, at some point, we start looking at the information we've gathered. If the atom to 13 is low normal, those are, you're right, tougher ones. I agree with you that it tends to be undetectable, definitely under 5% if it's real TTP. The other thing I say is, where is the autoantibodies? Don't forget that low atom to 13 activity is the first thing. The second thing is to find the autoantibodies. So if there's no autoantibodies, what is plasma exchange doing? Plasma exchange is not that helpful for congenital TTP because you don't have autoantibodies. Because then they'll say, well, there's no autoantibodies, it must be congenital TTP. I'm like, well, plasma exchange is meant to remove the autoantibodies from the circulation. Can you just give FFP? Actually, we've done that in a couple of cases where there's no autoantibodies. So I say, okay, I don't mind giving a little bit of FFP, but why do we need to exchange plasma if there's no, you know, autoantibodies there? So it's harder as an OB because, you know, I'm not a hematologist, I'm not a nephrologist, but I think that's why it's important to work together. I've now established, of course, that they trust me. They know that I do have some background. And so I have a team, people that I trust, and from the hematology side, the nephrology side, and we have those discussions together.
I don't know if you have any last words you wanted to say. I think it's been a great discussion of a topic that's becoming more and more important, I think, as the treatments get better. And a problem that I think is often missed has been my experience. I often get called second go round, where it was missed the first time somebody came through this, and now they're postpartum and their kidneys are continuing to deteriorate. And the question is, what now? So obviously it'd be much, much better to pick it up early. But any final thoughts?
Thank you. Yeah, it's an important topic. I hope we can raise attention towards it. My final thoughts is reminding OBs that renal failure after pregnancy, you have to take that seriously. You have to consider the diagnosis of atypical HOS or other TMA disorders, because it cannot be explained simply by preeclampsia, HELLP syndrome, or other pregnancy conditions. So pregnancy-associated renal failure, that if a woman develops renal failure after a pregnancy complication, it's on us now to work up TMA disorders, think about atypical HOS. It can make a big difference for these women, dramatically change the course of their life and their health.
Thank you very much. That winds up another podcast from Blood, Sweat, and Smears. If you have any questions left over, you're very welcome to call me here at Maytion Diagnostics. Phone number is on the website. I'll talk to you with pleasure if you have an interesting case. Thank you very much.
That's it for us here at Blood, Sweat, and Smears, a podcast produced by Maytion Diagnostics, your reference lab and CRO specializing in thrombosis, hemostasis, and rare disease. Thank you for listening. And if you have a question or comment, or there's a topic you'd like Dr. Lewis to speak to, please send us an email to bloodsweatandsmears@machiondiagnostics.com. That's machaondiagnostics.com. You can follow Maytion at Twitter at MaytionDX. Be sure to subscribe to stay in the know, share this podcast with clinicians you think might appreciate it, and we hope you'll join us next time here at Blood, Sweat, and Smears.